It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The Mueller report is done. The Attorney General has issued a four-page memo, and now the fight begins with Congress on its release. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. What we know about the report put together by the independent counsel, Robert Mueller, comes through a memo issued by Attorney General Bill Barr. Its bottom line, not enough evidence to establish conspiracy with the Russian government's interference, the 2016 elections and the Trump campaign. No determination on whether the president obstructed justice during the investigation. And now House Democrats want to see the full report. Barr has offered to provide a redacted version expressing concerns over ongoing investigations and classified material. But House Intelligence Chairman Gerald Nadler says he wants it all. His committee voted to authorize subpoenas to get it. In our studio this morning to take a look at the unfolding events in the last few weeks, Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin, John Barkovich, local Republican in Wicomico County, a regular on our panel. So Adam Hoffman, he's chair of the political science department at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
Morning.
So, John, I'm going to start with you. The president seemed to take a victory lap immediately after the memo, the letter that Barr sent. But then things have gotten a little more complicated. What's your assessment from the moment that that letter was released to where we are now?
Well, I think I think the president was looking forward to resolving the issue one way or the other. And his supposition all along was this was a witch hunt, et cetera, et cetera. And so when the Barr conclusions came out, or the Barr summary came out, I think he was very happy. There was the concern that because I don't think he really knew what was coming. I don't think any of his lawyers knew what was coming. And so when he saw the conclusion from the Barr summary, I think he was very happy, and collusion delusion was then his statement. And I think he's very happy. And I think there has been a number of people who had been concerned about the potential for collusion, this non-crime crime. Certainly many were relieved. Many people who supported Trump didn't really care one way or the other. They were going to support Trump, whether there was collusion or not. That the base didn't really care. But there were some independents. There were some squishy Republicans, Democrats that might have supported Trump on many of the other issues that were concerned about this Russian collusion concept. And so I think when the summary came out, many of those people were relieved to see that. And what goes on after that remains to be seen, because I see another 2 years of controversy.
How do you think the president has handled this? And we'll get into this further, but as some now reaction has come, we've got some disgruntlement. I mean, is things getting a little more shaky?
What do you think? You have to understand, Trump never minds goading the opposition.
Right.
He's never been the shrinking violet that's afraid to express a statement that he might upset people who have been opposed to him. And I think his base loves it. I mean, they're very happy with that response. And so I think he understands that they're gonna continue to be after him. I don't think he says, oh, because of this Barr summary, I'm done with this problem. I don't think he has. But I think he's not afraid to goad the opposition, because in many respects, the continued banging on him for something that has been the witch hunt, I don't think hurts him going into 2020.
Michael Laughlin, what's your assessment about his initial reaction, what we saw, and we'll get into some of the details, and how this thing has played over the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think what's fascinating to me at this point is that it appears that Barr made a judgment to weigh in when actually he didn't have to weigh in. That is, Barr as Attorney General could simply have said to the Congress and to the public, we have to do some work. We have the report. We have to do some work to protect innocent folks who may have been grand jury witnesses and the like. That's going to take us some time. And until then, okay, we will say nothing. Instead, what Barr did is he weighed in. And the question becomes, did he weigh in politically? That is, if and when the report finally comes out, will his claims about essentially exonerating the president on the two major questions of obstruction of justice and the question of conspiracy? Or will the report reveal that he was speaking the truth, or he really weighed in to politically protect this president? And the problem that I think that Trump faces at this point is that now, particularly because we now see some pushback from some folks from the Mueller team complaining about that Barr misrepresented the report, there's trouble ahead now in any case. And the question becomes now, is it going to serve the president better politically if the report is dragged out for a longer period of time, or whether it comes out very quickly? And so now I think the complexity of the politics actually has increased.
Go ahead. Would you accept there's a difference between the collusion and the conspiracy in terms of what Barr said? Barr was very definitive about collusion. I mean, that was a definitive statement.
You mean obstruction, not
obstruction. Right. Yes, collusion versus obstruction. Right. Occlusion versus
right. obstruction. Two different things.
That he was very definitive.
Yes.
This was not a maybe, but in the obstruction issue, he was somewhat. It's not clear.
And to be clear,
there is interpretation yet to be accomplished.
Let's be clear, though, that there's a difference between conspiracy and collusion.
Understood.
Right. Yeah. The real question becomes, the Barr has made the claim that. The conspiracy charge has been, that the president has been exonerated from that charge. That doesn't mean that collusion is another phenomenon. That's actually, so in other words, there's a threshold. We still don't know the evidence. In other words, there's a question of legality of crimes committed in both the obstruction case and the conspiracy case has to do with the evidence, whether there's sufficient evidence in a court of law, right? To say yes, we could indict
without a crime. It's hard to get obstruction.
Yeah, but you don't. So we still don't know.
Tell that to Scooter Libby.
We still don't.
Yeah, no, actually, they can. You know, it's not uncommon for courts to charge obstruction even without an underlying crime. I mean, they're able to do that.
Yes,
they're able to do it. Right. Yeah. I'm not saying they're not able to do it. It's hard. It's a little more difficult to do it in terms of the president.
So I would agree with you that the straight up claim was made. There's no insufficient evidence of conspiracy, right? The question of obstruction of justice, though, of course, the report, even Barr said in his 4-page memo, there's evidence on both sides, and Mueller would not conclude.
And
make
therefore,
a conclusion
it's my decision.
Well, but
therefore,
Barr,
it's my decision.
No, but that was a judgment that he made, and there's no requirement that forced him to make that judgment. No.
Let me get Adam in here.
Sure.
Adam, you got to learn. You got to speak up.
All right. So, a couple of different crimes or potential crimes issues. So you have collusion. And in the case of collusion, I think Barr was correct in this case interpreting Mueller's report, saying that Mueller didn't find enough evidence to rise to the level of a prosecutable crime of collusion. However, I think as Mike is saying, that doesn't mean that if the full report goes to Congress, there's a possibility that they're going to find something else. In other words, they need to know about all the other things that Mueller went over to come to his conclusion that there wasn't any collusion, because we don't know. We don't know what he found with regard to the Trump's organization's business dealing to Russia, the Trump Tower Moscow talks, Donald Trump's junior's meeting with the Russian lawyer, Russia's efforts to influence U.S. policy in the Ukraine. The list goes on and on. That Congress should see in order to make their own assessment with regard to collusion. Now, obstruction, I think, in the same level, the Mueller report clearly said we cannot decide on obstruction. Mueller punted on that issue. I believe because he probably felt that Congress should deal with that issue and the Congress should determine whether or not all the things that are contained in the Mueller report rises to the level in their eyes of high crimes and misdemeanors. Because let's face it, that's where, that's where Congress is going with this, with the democratically controlled House. And, you know, I also agree with Mike with regard to, you know, Bill Barr, really screwed this up by, you know, imputing his own legal judgment on this issue when Mueller clearly did not intend for him to do that. But he sort of took it upon himself to, you know, interpret Mueller's report rather than giving it to Congress. And again, the question is, why did he do this? Did he do this as a favor to Trump in order to set the narrative of, you know, of a president who did not collude, you know, in other words, to reinforce the fact that it was a witch hunt? Or did he do it because of his belief that we know about from a memo that he wrote, right, that probably got him the job, which is that he does not believe a president can be charged with obstruction of justice. So no matter what he was reading in the Mueller report, that would have been his conclusion based on, you know, what we know his own ideology is about this issue.
Let me ask you this, Adam. How much do you think he might have been, and we're all speculating, how much do you think he might have been influenced by Jim Comey's experience in which he came out, made a statement, made characterizations, and, I mean— that had to be looming in the back.
Perhaps. But, you know, I mean, I find it just kind of ironic that, you know, so, you know, just to look at the Comey statement. So, you know, Comey came out and, you know, indicated that he wasn't going to charge Clinton, but, you know, made some sort of extramural comments about Clinton's recklessness, et cetera, thereby, you know, really damaging her campaign right before the vote was to occur. And, you know, at the time, Republicans are, you know, saying, oh, well, way to go, Comey, right, to set the narrative at that point. And now, all of a sudden, the Republicans are sort of upset and being really, really careful not to wade into those political waters. If they believe that something is going to come out that is derogatory and that makes the president look bad, right? It's sort of ironic how it's sort of twisted around now, that now suddenly— they're like, well, you know, we can't, you know, turn Department of Justice or the FBI into sort of a political branch.
I thought Republicans and Democrats were both upset with the Comey performance. Democrats because he presented stuff that they didn't want known in terms of she committed these crimes. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans because if she did all these things, how come she's not being prosecuted? So I don't think anybody was happy with Comey's performance, either side of the political aisle.
I think Trump was.
The Republicans wanted her to go to jail and— the Democrats.
Well, but Republicans got the second best thing, which is to sort of set the, bring out the emails again.
That as being both sides were upset with that.
I guess it depends who.
I understand.
Yeah.
Now, one other quick issue, you're saying, well, we're going to let the House decide about these legal issues, and so this fella Mueller, with his 40 FBI agents and 20 attorneys, his $30 million and over 2 years of investigation, has come up with some stuff, and it's not clear whether. But we're going to take care of it. Congressman, you're going to take care of this. Can you resolve this issue that we couldn't?
No, but that's that. I think that misconstrues the actual place of Congress. Congress is not a court.
Understood.
The question is not the issue before the Congress is not whether or not some particular crime has been committed, some law has been violated.
Right.
The question is whether the actions of this president rise as in terms of ethics, in terms of basic political morality and norms have
for
been
impeachment.
Violated.
Oh, yes, look at the impeachment.
Right. Is that where you're headed?
The proper role, okay. If you believe in the Madisonian notion of separation of powers, and that a government ought to be accountable,
understood.
And executives have to be held accountable, right? Well, then the place of that is the U.S. Congress.
Understood.
And so there is every reason that has little to do ultimately with partisan politics and the kind of seamy side of partisan politics, that the House of Representatives has an obligation to us, the public, to uphold their role, to holding a president accountable. And therefore, they have every right to see this report, right? And if it appears that the president has, in fact, committed some actions that are that are unethical, that are that violate the fundamental norms of a democratic polity, well, then they have an obligation to impeach.
So being unethical is a high crime?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Sure, it depends on what, you, the kind of violation of ethics, yes.
I mean, you know...
I don't think that's what the framers had in mind.
Well,
I don't think Madison meant that, but that's fine.
Right, but on the other hand, the framers didn't have in mind, you know, lying about extramarital affairs with an intern. I mean, you know, it's really, it is up to the interpretation of the House to determine what rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. And I think, I mean, just based on what we know that's in the public realm, there's a whole lot out there that possibly might rise to that level, you know. But again, we won't know unless the report is released.
You're not going to see the report unless it's somehow illegitimately Pentagon Papers-like exposed. Barr is not going to let secret testimony
unless he's ordered by the Supreme Court.
Unless it's ordered by the Supreme Court.
Right. It could be fast-tracked.
Okay. Good. Excellent.
It could be fast-tracked.
That'll take.
I mean, they did
that
with the Nixon tapes. Yeah, they did with the Nixon tapes.
Because the comparison, the comparison between Starr and Mueller is entirely different. The laws are entirely different now than they were. This is a different investigation by a different kind of prosecutor.
Although I wonder sometimes whether or not that what you're looking at, John, is really trying to fasten yourself onto a technical issue as opposed to the substance of the issue. That is to say, you know, for instance, we've talked about, like, for instance, with Clinton. Clinton was never charged with obstruction of justice. Right. He was never charged with perjury. In fact, the only thing he got was a slap on the wrist about not being truthful, but it did not commit perjury. Yet the Congress decided that he had obstructed justice and he had committed perjury.
Right.
They took it upon themselves in that instance to do that.
And the results of that were terrible for the Republican Party.
Well, yes, it was. But it was just a political issue. But so if you have, and maybe Adam can weigh in, but if you have Congress making a determination of saying, well, maybe this isn't a legal issue, but if we step back and say the technical issues are aside, this is something in substance we can't abide by.
Right.
Adam?
Yeah, no. I mean, again, similar to what Mike said, once... So even if the report doesn't come out, then certainly Congress is within its place to call Mueller and other witnesses, Don Jr., everyone else who was involved in this, in order to show the public, in order to make the case to the public that this does perhaps rise to that level of high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, clearly, you know, the Republicans. You know, one reason why that didn't work out well for the Republicans in the Bill Clinton impeachment is because they didn't make that case effectively enough to the public on both sides of the aisle that what Bill Clinton did rose to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. So ultimately, when they did draw up the articles for impeachment but weren't able to impeach in the Senate, that came back to hurt them, basically, because most people felt that they did overstep and they weren't legitimately using their powers of oversight. But, you know, I think at this point, you know, it's so different with Trump because, I mean, again, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, you've heard so much of some of the things he's done, the unethical behavior, the illegalities, Michael Cohen's testimony. I mean, the list could go on and on and on. So I think for a lot of members of the House, they feel like they have a pretty good case to be made, especially as more, you know, as they subpoena more and more. I think they believe they'll have a pretty good case to present to the public that so much of what Trump has done rises to that level. But we'll see. And the question is, I mean, the big question is, can they get a single Republican on board? In the House, probably. In the Senate, probably not, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, that the Democratic leadership has been really reluctant to say the I word. Right?
Well, one of the things that also strikes me about the difference between the Clinton impeachment as opposed to where we are now is that the Clinton impeachment ultimately got wrapped up in this idea that he had this affair that he lied about.
Right.
That's one thing. And I think that the public, in the end, separated us. And because initially, by the way, some people, when they took the immediate polls afterwards, they said, well, this is true. God, he should leave office. By the time they got to the impeachment, everybody got used to it. Well, okay, fine, right? Here you have issues which not only are greater than just simply an affair, but do impact on the state itself, sure, and the nature and the national security, mm-hmm, those kinds of issues. And it seems to me that that may be one of the avenues by which the Democrats will be able to achieve, say, some kind of support for their activity, because it is more substantive. And you saw, for instance, in the Clinton situation, the president actually became far more popular as the issue went on. Not only has Trump not achieved the popularity that Clinton did even initially, but I don't think if we project down the road, we're going to be looking at increasing popularity as this thing goes on. I mean, I'm just making this, this comparison. No. Well, I mean, I know he's talking to the base. I got that one.
No.
You see what I'm talking about?
Again, I don't know, porn star blue dress, that's kind of, who knows how the public.
Right.
But I still think in terms of what kept Clinton protected was at that time we had a viable economy. Things were, people in their lives were doing well. Clinton had worked with the Republican House to accomplish some significant things. So I think, again, you say, well, Clinton won, but that was because he was doing, the country was doing well. And then the guy at the kitchen table talking to his wife was going, yeah, he did that, but we're doing okay. And so I think that's still part of my algebraic determination, mm-hmm, of what's going on now, is although there's not a whole lot of media support for what's going on in the country, at least most people feel that at least they are doing well. Their jobs are there, there is wages are increasing, the stock market's doing great, and so they go, yeah, okay, maybe, we don't really know what Don Jr. did in his 20-minute meeting, but we know he testified for it for about 27 hours, so it's probably not much going on there. And besides that, Trump's doing a pretty good job. My family's doing well, we've got some issues that still have to be resolved, but I think he's doing a pretty good job. And so I think that's still what it's going to come down to, is are people in their daily lives comfortable, successful, doing better than they were 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, in which case Trump will get a lot of leeway. On the other hand, if things turn in terms of economics, in terms of all the other issues that are yet before us, then that might go away.
Michael, what about that, the dynamic of the economy itself? I mean, we just had a report this morning that the country added about 190,000 jobs, I think it is. So it looks as if we're continuing on with this very long boom. Is that going to have an impact in terms of Trump's popular or viability of getting through this?
Absolutely.
Politically?
No, I think John actually makes an excellent point that if the economy, incumbent presidents, I mean, this is no longer is this a new candidate for president. This is an incumbent president, and with an economy, if the economy is sustained, if it's durable, and if we go into the 2020 election with a stable economy, for a lot of folks who don't have other issues that they're concerned about, they may, as some analysts have argued, that go for the default president, going back to the default question. The problem, however, that Trump faces, as some pollsters have analyzed recently, is that when you look at this president, he has never gotten above 47% or 44%, right? Whereas all the other incumbent presidents, right, even George H. Walker Bush got up at one point, the Gulf War was up to 80% or so.
That's true.
Approval. Donald Trump remains a minority president in terms of public opinion. And what's also interesting in the light of the Mueller report debate over that is that even with Barr's report that essentially puts says, the president is doing okay. That has not changed. The public, he has not
gained. He didn't get a bump.
He didn't even get a bump from that. What may be baked into this particular electoral cycle is that clearly Democrats are going to remain solidly against Trump, but that the independents that the shift there, that despite a favorable economy, the dislike of Trump and the suspicion that Trump is corrupt, the suspicion that Trump is completely incompetent in terms of public policy, may weigh heavily against him. So the possibility for him, his chances of election really require him to repeat what he did in the 2016 election, most likely.
Which polls didn't suggest he was going to win, just like polls
now.
I always come back to that.
But to be fair, one has to understand, no, the polls weren't necessarily wrong. It was that they weren't overall, they were right. But in individual states,
they didn't hold enough in Wisconsin, basically.
Right.
And the states where it mattered.
Right. So he's going to have to essentially thread that needle once again. He could lose again the popular vote.
And I actually expect him to lose the popular vote again.
But we're in such a different place than we were in 2016. I mean, people, you know, obviously did not know, you know, where this president would go. I mean, if you told, you know, all the Trump voters, you know, where we would be today and where we would have all these issues, I think some of them wouldn't believe you. But, you know, to go back to the point of the calculus that people make, people vote with their pocketbooks. This is something that, political scientists have confirmed with empirical studies for many, many decades. However, you know, as Mike said, that is mitigated. People do, as you said, people do they weight. They weight the issues. They weight, how am I doing economically? And what do I think of the direction the country is going? What do I think of this president? And I think, you know, it's impossible. You would have to be, you know, living in a plastic bubble to not have heard of the plethora of things that Trump has done. What are we up to, 9,000 times that he lied or something, about 22 a day? Inflating his financial figures to get loans, all the investigations in the Southern District Court of New York, so many other inquiries with regard to the emoluments issue, whether or not his financial interests are influencing the way he conducts foreign policy. I think, you know, when people are weighting the totality of all these issues with their, you know, economic success or how they feel about how they're doing economically, I think that scale will tend to get will move in the direction of not supporting this president, which, again, I think that goes to why his approval rating continues to be so low, because more and more of this comes out, and it's going to continue to come out.
So cutting taxes, turning the economy around
for the rich,
turning the economy around for everybody. Everybody's wages
taxes,
are going
though.
Up. I understand. That's what got the economy going. deal with the border, destroy ISIS. I mean, were those campaign promises he made in 2015? I think they were. Has he done his best within the current? Yes, I believe so, and so do most other people. Now, how do those issues stack up to emoluments questions? Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, most people around the kitchen table, they're not worried about emoluments. They're talking about their taxes, their economy, and ISIS is gone.
But John, the evidence doesn't support you on that because you're correct. It seems to me that he did follow through on a number of those issues, but it is incorrect to say when that has persuaded the American public. The polling indicates it's persuaded his base. To stick with him. Yeah. But that hasn't persuaded the rest of the country to do that, correct? I mean, the evidence is not on your side with regard to that. And then the question becomes, I mean, the White House must say, that those same people in the White House must say, thank God for Mitch McConnell. Because Trump has wanted to close the border with Mexico.
Right.
Okay. And Mitch McConnell basically says, you do that, Mr. President, you're going to destroy not only your chances, but the rest of us are going to go down the well with you, because the economy is going to
tank.
Yeah, well, because if you close the border.
Right.
So Mitch McConnell basically says, no, we're not going to do that. Right. Trump backs off.
Right.
Trump says, we're going to get rid of Affordable Care Act, right?
Okay. Can't.
Mitch McConnell says, no, Mr. Trump, we're not going to do that, because if we take on that issue, we're going to tank.
Right.
Because the last thing we need is for health care the issue that won the House of Representatives back for the Democrats. The last thing we want is for health care to be the salient issue for the next election cycle.
Well, health care will be an issue in the next cycle.
Well, yeah.
But it'll benefit the Democrats, though, I think.
I'm not
most
sure
likely.
That,
but we'll see. Yeah, but you don't want to make that the marquee issue for the Republicans because they have nothing. And Mitch McConnell is one of the really the most important figures in the Republican Party today.
No question.
Yep. And he's basically calling it. He's saying, well, if the health care issue was going to be a marquee item that he thought the Republicans could win on, he would have embraced Trump on that point. But the very fact that he basically told Trump...
McConnell's a realist.
Yes, he is.
No, McConnell's a realist.
Yeah. And he said, we're not going to do
that. And Trump's the big picture guy. And McConnell's going, no, you can't do that. Because Trump was saying, I'm going to close the border because he knows it's going to hurt Mexico more than it hurts us. And then when he said that, that was a threat to Mexico. That wasn't a threat to us. The avocado people were very upset that they were going to lose avocados for three weeks. But I think the threat was there to Mexico. That was an attempt to get Mexico to do something. And similarly with healthcare, the threat was there. And so he's backed off because McConnell said, appropriately and rightfully so, they can't get anything changed now. But that change may be required when the Supreme Court takes care of the Obamacare issue. And now we have to do something. And I think that's where that's going to go. Healthcare will have to be determined at some point in time because Obamacare is going to go away ultimately because it is unconstitutional without the previous tax incentive issues that caused the Chief Justice to vote to keep Obamacare. And that now is gone. I think he goes the other way. We lose Obamacare. That will then force Congress to do something. And I think that's what Trump is looking at. It's going to be forced on us, and that will then give me an opportunity to say, here's what we need to do.
Let me add up, because he brings up the Supreme Court, and I've been sort of puzzling about this, you know, where is Roberts going to fall?
Mm, yeah.
Roberts, amongst other things, is an institutionalist.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering whether or not he's going to follow John's prescription, which makes, you know, it can make sense, to upend this law, which has been so embedded in the healthcare system now, mm-hmm. that, you know, perhaps we shouldn't go ahead and overturn it. And I'm thinking, particularly when I think about something like, the same-sex marriage issue as an example, is another thing where it became so embedded in public opinion that the court finally, a conservative court, said, okay. And I'm just wondering whether or not Roberts is going to be looking at this and looking at his own legacy and say, maybe I don't want to do this.
I would tend to agree. I mean, Roberts is one of the few conservatives on the court that, you know, I wouldn't consider as much of a Republican operator as some of the other justices. I think he clearly, you know, looks at things, he looks at the reputation of the court, which has taken, you know, a tremendous number of hits, since Gore v. Bush. I think the other justices, especially the new justices, will tend to vote with the conservative Republican appointees who vote consistently to favor conservative causes. Your Alito and Thomas and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, I think, you know, one quarter. But I think, you know, Roberts will, break the tie in the case, you know, especially if you have Breyer, with the liberals as well on this issue of Obamacare, because he does not want to, as you said, you know, upend something that is, you know, that is important to so many Americans. And again, he is thinking of the reputation of the court, I think, going forward. And I think you could say the same thing about, you know, if the Mueller case comes before the Supreme Court, you know, I think you're going to, again, have a similar breakdown of justices where you're going to have, again, the more conservative justices, you know, probably siding with Barr and Republicans who want to keep a lot of it redacted and a lot of it, not released to Congress. But I think you're going to have the Chief Justice, again, making the difference in deciding in favor of, you know, a full release of the report to Congress, if it comes to that.
What turned to the issue, by the way, of taxes? Because apparently the Democrats want to see the president's taxes, at least the last 5 years anyway, which has been issued. And I'll ask, well, Michael, I'll ask you. So what do you make of that, and what do you think they're going to be finding?
Well,
what are they looking for?
Yeah, I think the in the context of all of the information we know about the kinds of problems that this president has had with, in the past. I mean, there's a lot of information out there already that suggests unethical behavior, but also the possibility of criminal behavior, because you have other courts investigating parts of this as well. So, and so that the Congress is its effort to get the taxes, I think, is on sound ground to say we have good reason to suspect that wrongdoing, in fact, has been done. And therefore, to hold this president accountable, like all previous presidents, because all previous presidents have divulged their taxes, we have a right to see that in the name of accountability and the name of the public should know whether or not this president has a corrupt background or not, because. You know, perhaps a review of the taxes will show that he's done nothing wrong. Yeah, and so the transparency, the question of, I mean, it's a fundamental question of democratic transparency. The Washington Post says democracy dies in darkness. That's right. And what the Congress is trying to do in terms of taxes is we need transparency. We need sunlight in here. It seems to me that the critique that somehow this is simply a question of partisan pursuit, I just think that should fall on deaf ears.
Well, the difference is that Donald Trump is a billionaire. He has multiple.
So he claims.
Let's say he's only a multimillionaire. Okay. He is a businessman with multiple issues in terms of taxes. And I know, and I'm a simple country doctor, that taxes are very complex even for me. And I can imagine the number of accountants, et cetera, that are involved in his tax preparation. I understand why he's probably being audited for the last whatever. Who cares? But for once, we have a president who has not had that kind of background that has been easy to evaluate prior, because he's not a politician. He has not been subjected to years and years and years of scrutiny in his simple practice as a politician, okay, and constantly showing his tax records every time he runs for something. And so this guy comes out of the woodwork from a business background with multiple dealings, multiple issues that I'm sure many people in the United States won't ever understand, no matter how many times they are explained on MSNBC that this was terrible, not ethical, and you should never... They're never going to understand it, because it is a complex issue. And there is, in many cases, in black and white, not a black and white issue when it comes to taxes. And rich people all do it. They do it because they hire fancy people to get around the law, to keep as much of their money as they can. I sort of understand that. Now, is that right? No, it's not. But that's the law. And if he broke a law, then I'd be happy to see that. But
well, then we
I don't
should
expect,
see the taxes.
But you can't get... If I'm under audit, you're not going to see my taxes.
You understand it, but don't you want other Americans to understand it, too? If you understand it, shouldn't everybody understand it?
I would think there's a...
Maybe?
That most
or
of
no.
Them, no?
The issue
no,
is...
No, I think
but John, 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 John okay, the issue yeah. is not complexity.
Okay. I think part of the issue
no,
is complexity.
No, it's not. The issue is transparency. Complex or simple, we ought to see the tax returns. This is the President of the United States. Is the President of the United States accountable to the public?
He's accountable to the people
who voted
for
him.
They voted for him without seeing his taxes, and they'll vote for him again without seeing his taxes. I'm just telling you.
Sure, you can complain about it.
But the reality
is... But let's see if they vote for him after seeing his taxes. I mean, can I just say one thing about this as far as... him trying to hide something. I don't know if you read the latest news this morning, where a report came out that he's pressing McConnell to quickly...
Approve.
The general, I think the general counsel of the IRS, which is, I think, another FOT, friend of Trump, before this fight for the taxes proceeds, which I find, again, just remarkable as far as the audacity of the president to put you know, to attempt to put, you know, cronies and people in places that are clearly there to protect any possible wrongdoing. And I think to some extent, the Attorney General was you know, applied for the job and got the job because of how he felt about whether or not the president could be prosecuted. And similarly, I suspect this IRS person.
And this underscores that the Congress's responsibility is to try to make sure that the president does not abuse power. And what we have again and again here, and this is simply another example of this president who abuses, is he's pursuing an imperial and imperious presidency, where he thinks nothing of the protection of the ethical character of our institutions. And he's corrupting them one after another. I mean, the other one, the question of the new guy who he wants to appoint to the Federal Reserve.
Herman Cain. Yes, we all recognize the guy is a joke,
right? And he's but this president has no compunction about thinking about competence or underlying expertise.
And this is supposed to be a nonpartisan,
and this
obviously
supposed to be
not, as the IRS is supposed to be a nonpartisan agency.
So I think there's the other issue.
As it
this
was
is
when
where,
they didn't give tax.
I knew you.
That was pretty nonpartisan in my way of thinking.
Well, they're supposed to be.
Oh, okay.
I think from a fundamental question of the long term in terms of the institutions, I mean, the credibility and the respect for our institutions, this president is a corrupting influence. Put aside whether or not the partisans, whatever. That is a serious matter that lies before us, which I think any members of Congress, Republicans also.
No, there are some Republicans that are nervous.
Yeah, I'd like to
it's
see.
It's the first time we've had a businessman running the country.
I just think Trump is so goal-oriented
that he tends to not look.
No, he's a kleptocrat is what he is.
Okay, good. Are we going to get to cow farts before we get done today?
Well, by the way, it's just to be clear. By the way, in terms of the House Ways and Means Committee, the law that he's asking for these or demanding these, the law says that they shall turn this thing over. It's not a matter of will. So, I mean, in one sense, it may not make any difference who he appoints to head the chief counsel or the IRS or any of those folks.
It won't be determined by the legal aspects. It'll be in court.
Oh, yeah.
Everything ends up in court when there's a question.
I'm curious, though, and I'll have to shoot this to Adam. So out of all of this, the taxes is just sort of one thing. Do you think we're going to see down the road, probably not this year or next, but down the road, Congress enacting laws that are going to shore up and make sure that a president doesn't do X, Y, and Z. For example, if anybody running for president, they have to have their taxes, so many taxes released, or they can't do certain things.
I think that has to be done at the state level, though. I mean, because of the way election law
is played out.
And again, you know, I mean, there's really nothing that the Congress could do with regard to, you know, some significant reform like that unless they get some Republicans in the Senate to be on board. And it doesn't seem like they're able to do that for just about any issue that involves improving what Trump has done.
Do you think, though, that down the road, once Trump disappears, let's assume, for instance, that he's not reelected.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see Congress then taking a serious look at saying, okay, there are some of the problems we saw in the last administration, in terms of contacting people, asking people to, give Michael Flynn a break, these kinds of contacts, whether or not they might approve laws that will fine tune this, as they did after, say, Watergate.
You know what? I don't think there's as many institutionalists in Congress, and I think it becomes a partisan issue. And if there's a Democrat in office at the time, no, I don't think they're going to do that, right? I mean, because they're going to want that Democrat to continue to have the sorts of power that that exist in the executive. I don't know. Maybe Mike disagrees.
I fear you're right in that respect, but that's a fear, because I think the proper response would be that we need to we're on a track now of, like, once again of an imperial presidency, mm-hmm. and power being expanded for for the
future presidents,
right. Whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Mm-hmm. And from a Democratic point of view, with a small d, from the question of, for the public, to what extent the Congress is our best institution for collective decision making, for us to actually have power in at the federal level. And to the extent that Congress's power is fading and the president's power is expanding, we're losers. We're losers from a Democratic point of view. And so I would hope that there would be a movement in Congress to really tighten up a lot of these rules. I mean, so if a candidate yells out to Russia and says, please give me all your emails, that ought to approach a criminal offense. That ought to approach that you are, in fact, inviting foreign interference in our elections. And to the extent that that is insufficient for a criminal offense, perhaps that kind of thing needs to be examined, so that the law needs to be tightened up, so that future candidates cannot do that. Right? And if they do, they cross the line, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Right. I mean,
live by the sword, die by the sword. From my point of view, the key for us is that we still have a constitution, and that has provided the checks and balances over the years, and I think still will, because as a small D Democrat, we look at the large D Democrat who ran this country for the 8 years prior to Trump. Most of what he did was done with executive fiat. Okay, so for 8 years that's the way it was, and didn't seem to bother anybody. So now, 2 years into the Trump's 8 years, we see all of a sudden that's bad, and you can't have it both ways.
But in principle, I would agree with that, actually.
But the issue here is, and it's over a gamut of things. I mean, you can talk about executive orders, and some of which were actually bumped back by the Supreme Court. But all of these issues, it seems to me, it would be within the Republican interest, once we get beyond this period, to say, well, wait a minute, we need to rein this stuff in, because we don't want, say, for instance, a Democratic president calling up the Attorney General and saying, prosecute X, Y, or Z, for example, right? There's those kinds of things, it seems to me, are bipartisan in nature. And so the question I have to you is, isn't the Republican Party interested in that kind of reining it in? Maybe they're doing things for politics for the moment, but down the road, they could be the loser. One of the things that, for instance, McConnell has done away with, say, for instance, the filibuster and a number of issues.
Nuclear option.
Right? Yeah. So now we're looking at, down the road, if the Democrats control the Senate, they're going to be pushing through a whole slew of appointments on the bench.
No question.
So there was a sacrifice there that the McConnell made.
Game,
yeah.
Basically.
So, I mean, do you think that Republicans will look at this and overall, let's say, there are some things we need to rein in. I mean, with some things, you know, we looked at the Trump presidency, there and security clearances and so on. I mean, they say, well, wait a minute. Maybe there's something we need to do here.
It would have to be something much more, much, much clearer to the public as a whole than anything that's been brought up today. Okay? I don't think there's been anything that rises to the limits to the concept of high crimes.
But beyond
the way things are going.
Right. I'm talking about impeachment. I'm talking about saying, okay.
I understand.
Maybe it's not impeachable to, for instance,
but
to talk
Mike
to.
But when Mike says, you know, he's picked a fellow for the Federal Reserve who I think is a clown. I mean, you know, that's his prerogative. That's within the law. He can do that. And so when McConnell says, well, we've now moved not only from Supreme Court to regular judicial appointments, and we're going from, you know, 30 hours to 2 hours, and it takes, you know, I mean, that's something that has been established not by Trump or Trump supporters. That was established by the previous administration. So, I mean, we're reacting to a lot of things now and saying, oh, this is terrible, when it wasn't really instituted or started or begun during this presidency. Trump has used what's been available to him by the past. And so at some point in time, if everybody agrees that, well, it was wrong for President Obama and it was wrong for Trump, and we want to make sure it's wrong for anybody going forward, I think that is potentially possible, but it's going to be something much more significant than anything I've seen so far.
Well, and I think it'll happen. I mean, you're right in the sense that, you know, Trump has used powers that exist, but it's the way he's used them. So in other words, I think if and when enough people see that he's used these powers in an abusive way.
That's nuance.
Well,
no.
Well,
Well, that's nuance.
It's a nuance.
If you gave me the power and I use it the way I want, if you don't like it, then get rid of me in 2020.
That's quite a possibility that's going to happen.
And that may happen.
Or but, change I mean, the power.
Isn't that the way our republic is made to work?
But you could pass a law that requires all candidates running for president to divulge their taxes.
Exactly. Right. You could.
That doesn't exist now.
It does.
Right. So Congress could do that.
I'm not sure it would pass if you did that as a national referendum tomorrow.
Well, some states are already doing that. In other words, candidates cannot get on their ballot in a state unless they release their taxes.
That would be a way of tightening up certain laws, right? That would make our democracy more transparent, or our government more transparent. Right. So those are the kinds of things that could be pushed.
Right. And I would agree that they could be pushed. But I don't see any national swell for anything that's occurred thus far.
Mm-hmm. Although I would suggest that individuals in Congress, whatever the public sentiment is or feels like or the depth, may say, it's in my self-interest to do this. Right? I mean, it's in my self-interest to, say, limit the powers of the presidency in one fashion or another, whether or not there's some great public support for it or not. It's my personal interest.
Right, and these things have to build. I mean, take, for instance, the Electoral College. I mean, for the first time after, many, many years of that, being an issue in this past election, it's an issue that finally kind of has feet, and you have some mainstream members of Congress, Democrats in this case, who are, now adopting the possibility, that possibility of doing away with the Electoral College.
It will never happen. That's an example of that. Now we're getting close to my cow flatulence in terms of that's never going to go away, because the founders put the Electoral College in to do just what it has done for centuries, give every state the opportunity to weigh in on the choice of president. And so, the states on the coast would love to see the Electoral College go away, but the majority, the constant majority, would never allow that to happen. So, yes, it's great for Democratic candidates to go up and say, this is terrible, and oh, you people in New York and California who voted for Hillary and didn't get her elected, it's terrible. And then the people in Missouri, Ohio, Michigan, they go, well, you know what, we had to have a say in this too.
The other issue, example, though, I think of a possibility of tightening up, I'm reminded of the War Powers Act. Hmm. That came forward after the Nixon years, and the push there was an attempt by the Church Committee. Right, to tighten up the question of when the United States is going to go to war. I mean, to be sure, it has not
worked. That effect.
But I think
there's an example. It's always more difficult.
But I do think that that's the kind of possibilities that we could perhaps try to encourage to see full forward.
And I'd be willing to have that discussion.
It didn't have that effect because, look, let's face it. I mean, the president gets in there, and each president takes it upon himself to expand the powers of the office. And, not enough people are paying attention to say anything, right? So not enough people are paying attention to say, wait a second, you can't do that, right? So there hasn't been, that hasn't been that groundswell, to make those sort of radical reform changes on a lot of those things.
But that goes back to my argument. What are they most concerned about? Go ahead. I'm paying my bills.
Right.
What's the price of gasoline? Are the kids advancing in school?
Sure. But I think a lot of these issues also, people do not, not enough people make the connections between some of these issues and how that impacts their bottom line, how it impacts the job they have, how it impacts whether or not their kids are going to go to school. And look, politicians try to make those connections and connect those dots, on both sides.
By the way, I just want to, before we wrap up here, security clearances. We just had a whistleblower come out 25. She said no, and they overrode her anyway. Apparently, Jared Kushner is amongst those.
He's giving them away like Oprah.
So is the White House janitor. Yeah. I'm really nervous about him.
And we have Jared Kushner, who, as I understand it, has been pushing for some nuclear deal with the Saudis, while the Saudis have been shoring up his disaster of a real estate deal at 666, whatever it is. What about security clearances and these conflicts that exist? I mean, obviously, it's, and this is, I think one would say, this is why you don't hire your family. Right. You can't fire them, right?
Or unqualified people. It's pretty frightening, and I think this is another example of you know the incompetency of this administration. I mean, people risk their lives basically, for issues for you know things that are communicated to people with the proper security clearances, and when you have an administration giving them out like Trump gives, like Oprah gives out gifts, you know, on her show, I think that becomes a really, really frightening and incompetent thing to do.
It's an example, once again, of abuse of power, I think.
Because he's giving them to friends, correct, to people correct. Who will support
so,
him,
so
to other
simply,
yes men.
It's not simply incompetence, it's an abuse of power, because you're overriding, unless you don't think the security clearance rules are constructive. And that's there's an argument, you can debate that, but let's assume for a moment that they are reasonable, mm-hmm. right, and they protect the country from people who can otherwise be blackmailed and to be compromised. This president is overriding all of that, and that clearly strikes me as once again an abuse of power for right. this president.
But who, by law, who ultimately gets to determine clearance? President of the United States. Sorry, okay, he can do it. And so to sure. complain about Jared Kushner getting clearance so that he can go to the Middle East and he can work on a crime bill and go to China and work to accomplish good for his father-in-law, to say that, well, it's he shouldn't have done that. He can do it. The law allows him to do it.
But that doesn't mean he has to.
It doesn't mean he has to, or it doesn't mean that you,
or that
you should
or
like
it's wise.
It. But
or
that's
it's wise.
What the law is.
Sure, but yes. it's unwise, and it's an abuse of power once again. But you're right, the president has discretionary power. You don't want to... Look, your critique of Barack Obama for all those executive orders.
Yes.
Okay? The law says he can do that.
He can do it.
Yeah.
He could. He was legal.
I don't recollect that you were saying, well, that's fine. That's fine for him to do it.
He should not do that.
I
oppose many of those decisions.
Because it's abuse of power.
No,
the Republican
Party. Okay. Well, no, I understand. That's fine.
Do we face
that's
a lawless fine. President,
that's
people?
Fine.
That's what the whole rhetoric was.
Republicans did say that.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate that, John.
There's lots of things presidents can do.
And I guess you're saying the same thing about my president. So, I mean... We're even there.
Well,
so
it's abuse of power.
That's fine.
But the question that you could say, so you can say it's abuse of power, and therefore, right, should not be done. Right.
See, he's a pragmatist, and if I can do it, and it's within the law, and it accomplishes the task I want, I'm going to do it. And if Mike and Adam don't like it, I'm sorry, but I'm within my legal rights.
But he has no idea of the repercussions of it, and he doesn't listen to the people in his administration that could tell him what the repercussions of that are. That and that's one of the big problems of this presidency.
He has had a lot of turnover.
You think?
Yeah.
Well,
okay. But don't lose sight of the fact.
That he can.
Yes,
okay? I agree.
And
I agree.
As long as he can, and he does something that I'm happy with, I'm all for it.
Okay, real quick, just a couple of words. Start with you, John. Where does this Mueller stuff go in a few words?
Oh, it's going to be on and on. It'll be at least 2 years. It won't be resolved until the 2020 election. If Trump gets elected again, it'll continue after that.
Something to look forward to. Adam?
I'm a little more optimistic. I think Barr knows that he screwed up. And he up until this point, had a really, really good reputation. And I think I'm somewhat optimistic that he's going to try to remedy the situation by releasing a good deal of this report. And if not, Congress will call the relevant parties and subpoena them before the House and find out what is in the report.
Mike, 30 seconds.
One way or the other, the report's going to come forward, right? Even if it's Pentagon style.
Somebody's got a Xerox machine
Pentagon
out
paper
there.
Style.
So it's now a thumb drive.
Mueller was
a
good guy until he said no collusion. Is that kind of where we are with this? Mueller was a good guy until he said no collusion. And Barr was a good guy until he says the truth is this.
Okay, we would speak with Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin, John Barkovich, she's a local Republican here in Wicomico County, regular on our panel. Also, Adam Hoffman, he's chair of the political science department at Salisbury University. Appreciate a lively discussion. No doubt we will do this again. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.